Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer, Jacob Kanzler, Abigail Wallace, Simon Schuster, and the boss, John Roerink. A little later, Simon's got a potpourri of interviews from the Democratic State Convention over the weekend. We'll go over some of those names that he was able to track down a little later. But first, let's get some reports. Jake, we'll start with you in Grand Rapids. I'm going to be honest, guys. I was not excited about this weekend's conventions because there didn't seem to be a heck of a lot of drama there, was it?
There was not. In fact, that was the quote from Bill Schuette or Ronald Romney McDaniel, who said one of the same thing, that it was a no-drama convention, which I think they said with some delight.
Let's talk about, though, then, how did they get folks excited in this? I mean, here you've got the governor who's speaking at a convention where he's not even excited about the top of the ticket. So what was the, give us a little feel of what the atmosphere was like there in Grand Rapids.
With getting people excited, I think there was plenty of emphasis put on Hillary Clinton and really just demonizing her in any way, shape, or form. I mean, there was talk about Trump, and there was talk about just the importance of winning and winning the White House, and so that's where the energy was. But again, just a lot of energy put on taking down Hillary Clinton. Governor Snyder spoke. He didn't mention Trump, but the ambassador, John Bolton, made the whole speech about just the foreign policy. It's very similar to what Trump's been talking about with foreign policy, that our world's a mess. It's because of the Obama-Clinton machine. And so I think that's where they tried to rally the troops up as best they could.
Who got the best reception and who got maybe not so good a reception from the crowd?
That's tough to tell. I mean, the atmosphere at the convention was not the raucous atmosphere that we are used to at the Trump events. That's for sure.
So it was more subdued, people milling around.
Yeah, very subdued. The headliners themselves did not capture everyone's attention. So Snyder and Bolton didn't really, like, galvanize everyone. I will say that Nicolette Snyder, in a smaller form, may have won her State Board of Ed bid because of the speeches she was making at the caucus meetings. That's really the best way I can answer that question.
Nicolette Snyder, State Board of Education. That was the highlight. But what made her so compelling?
She's criticizing past State Board of Ed people who had used that to elevate their own careers. And she said she wants it to be about the kids. But she said in a very passionate way that I think got people kind of riled up. So she got good response in her speech, and that's what got her bid, I think.
I guess that's the wrap from the Republican convention in Grand Rapids. Let's move to Lansing now, Simon, where it kind of seemed like a bit of the same thing in that there was not a lot of drama. How would you describe the atmosphere?
It was, for the most part, you know, very smooth sailing. Not a whole lot of any sort of drama or contention happened. But I think that the Democrats really kind of carried the national message from the DNC that this election itself is kind of like a referendum on pluralism. And it's about whether or not we're going to be tolerant of all these minority groups that they are so explicit and so repeatedly saying that Trump is excluding, and whether or not the Democrats are really embracing with open arms.
Interesting here that, again, there wasn't much drama. Board of Ed was about it, but John Stewart dropped out before there was ever a vote. So that was all scripted. As far as speeches, who got the most attention and who was kind of tuned out?
Well, I think that Dan Kildee had a very successful speech. I mean, I don't think that there's any more sort of rumors about whether he's going to run for governor. I think that it's pretty a presumptive candidacy. His speech really was more or less a condemnation of the Snyder administration and what he perceives as Rick Snyder's legacy in Lansing. And especially, you know, the strikes home with his repeated reference to his hometown, Flint. But I think that their keynote address from Wendy Davis, the Texas legislature, who, you know, she became famous for an abortion rights filibuster that lasted 11 hours on their state senate. It really kind of was a dud of a speech. It was a lot of stock material. She'd been around the state stumping for Clinton. That was her fourth event, I think, since Friday. And most of the audience talked through it. It seemed that they were really disinterested.
Who was there and who was not there? Always kind of an interesting thing at these conventions. Dan Kildee was there. You didn't see Gretchen Whitmer there.
No, I did not see Gretchen Whitmer. And I mean, if she was there, her presence was not something of high visibility. You know, that, and I think that's going to be one of the big questions is, you know, where does she stand in relation to her gubernatorial aspirations?
And then we didn't touch on this in Grand Rapids, though, but Bill Schuette was there. Brian Kelly was?
Yeah, so Bill Schuette was up front and prominent. He had signs up everywhere. Just saying that he was the attorney general and that he's on duty, and he also ran the convention as the chair. The lieutenant governor was apparently in town on Friday. I did not see him make a speech. I was in two of the caucus rooms, and everyone paraded around to all of them, so you presume if he was part of that train, he would have. So I didn't see him make a speech. He apparently made an appearance in Grand Rapids on that night, according to a spokesperson, but on Saturday he was officially scheduled to run a race in Flint, so he was definitely not there on Saturday.
Not just a race, but the crim. That's big time. That's big time. One of these days I'm going to run it myself. Jack, we've covered conventions before. Kind of give me your perception on the importance or non-importance of these events.
Well, it depends on the convention. It depends on what's decided there. It depends on, in some cases there are actually contested situations. In some cases there is actually some question about what's going to happen here, there, et cetera, in different races. The problem is, for reporters, sometimes you go to these kind of events and virtually everything's already been decided ahead of time. It's just a matter of we're going to, you know, put the stamp of approval on everything that everyone already knows is going to happen. And I think that really kind of sets the stage for whether a convention is interesting or not interesting. To me, is there any drama? Is there any, you know, question about what's going to come out of this? Yeah. Or is anybody going to stick their foot in their mouth or do something like that? So really, I think that's the value of them in terms of, you know, news to me has always been, is there some question about what's going to happen? Obviously, if there's not much question about what's going to come out of this thing, I would question the value to a lot of people.
And I'm not going to disagree with anything he said in that case, because if you have drama, drama kind of begets excitement, right? You got people parading around, you get more people there because they feel like their votes matter for this race or that race. And we didn't have contested MSU board or U of M, and people seem to care about that because, you know, if you don't care about Michigan, then you probably care about state. If you don't care about state, you probably care about Michigan. That kind of seems to be the way things go. And, of course, Wayne State is there. All right, so why are you ducking your head like that? Oh, Wayne State's important, right? They just don't have a sports program. I mean, that's what makes the difference,
that's
right?
That's a very muted.
That's the most Midwestern thing I've ever heard.
You're going to cough and Greg Bird.
We love all our universities, Wayne State included.
As opposed to universities whose goal is to have a academic program that the sports department can be proud of.
I like that. All right, so moving on here. Last question I want to put on the table here before we head to the interviews. Donald Trump is allegedly going to be in Detroit this Saturday. Why does he love this state so much?
Michigan is a perfect test case for his arguments. He's argued that there are these groups of people that haven't voted ever or maybe haven't voted in a long time that are going to turn out, that are going to put him in office. If you look at Macomb, you remember the Macomb Democrats back that got Reagan elected. You look at the UP, he had really good turnout during the primary in the UP. I think they believe, if you look at those two geographies, that Michigan is a perfect test case to support his thesis that there are these mythical groups that are going to come out and vote for him that haven't voted in a long time.
And furthermore, if he can turn out crowds in a union, otherwise blue state, it doesn't matter if he can capture Michigan at this point. It is not even September yet. It's about the appearance of success and momentum in these previously unexcited, unenthusiastic groups.
Yeah, I completely agree with Abby's take in that, when you listen to Trump's speeches day after day, and he refers to these black voters that he's, you know, really going after hard, you know, with not a whole lot of success, he always references a few cities as like, you know, like black America, like Baltimore, Atlanta, and Detroit among them. And so I think that if he comes to Detroit and he feels like he's making progress, or at least the illusion of progress, you know, maybe it gets him towards his goal, but the question is whether or not he's really making any traction.
Wouldn't that be interesting, though? He has a speech in Detroit, and there's a bunch of Democrats and African-American voters show up, and it's practically booed the whole time. I mean, what kind of optics would that be?
Well, see, but this is the thing that Trump needs. Trump doesn't need actual support. He needs the line, thousands or hundreds gathered in Detroit. That's all he needs. The rest of it is details.
Jack, what's your thoughts here? Why does
I think there's a couple of takes on this. You could also ask, why is he in Mississippi? Why is he in Texas? Right now, he's going to a lot of places that have some people scratching their heads, but I think there are obviously some thoughts behind it. There's got to be some kind of strategy, whether it's a good strategy or not, that would be questionable. I think largely Detroit's a setting, first and foremost. Here's a setting for him to be making his pitch on the inner city stuff, on the black, trying to get the black vote approach, et cetera, et cetera. But the real question is, and I'm not the first one who's come up with this, is his discussion and his talk about going after the black vote really about going after the black vote, or is it about changing his image with more moderates? The idea is it really him trying to get the votes, or is it that he wants his image changed to make some other people more comfortable? And if you talk in terms of setting, I don't know if there's very many better cities in this country to use that as a setting than Detroit.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree with you, Jack, on that. I don't think at all his characterization of the black vote is designed to actually capture the black vote. I mean, he's practically talking about a caricature of what it's like to be African American in this country. So he's talking to a moderate voter. I
read an article too that went along that same thing. Someone opined that he's really trying to sound more appealing to the white voters he's already catered to make them, I don't know, think that he is inclusive of the black vote.
Well, anyway, he decided to have it on Saturday of Labor Day weekend, which really makes it not desirable to cover on a reporter front to blow up your... But Jack's volunteering.
Yeah, one more thing I wanted to say on that. If you think about it, that is consistent with the alterations on the immigration issue. I mean, this is... It looks like these are two different things happening, and yet they both actually may be the same thing. They may be heading the same direction.
It's like 2 months before the general, he realized he had to pivot to the middle.
All right, Simon, so you were able to catch up with some folks at the Democratic Convention. Tell me who's the first person you were able to talk to.
Well, I was able to talk to Ishmael Ahmed and John Austin as well. You know, they've been campaigning almost side by side throughout. And I think that, you know, a major issue for them is, or I guess a major issue that they are campaigning on is that idea of pluralism. I think that, you know, Ishmael Ahmed, you know, as a Muslim American, as someone who's a former auto worker, really kind of fits the description of what they want in a candidate. And he also has the experience to boot. He's a former director of the Department of Human Services, and he's, you know, very much a borderline progressive. And I think that it's really going to someone who can energize the base, especially among, you know, groups like the AFT.
All right, let's hear it.
You know, what you see is one of the themes of this election. You speak about, you know, bigotry, homophobia, sexism. Do you think that the idea of, you know, whether we embrace or reject pluralism as a nation is sort of the fulcrum upon which this election is going to hinge?
Well, that's what I've been saying as I go from district to district, caucus to caucus. But it's something I truly believe. And that is that this is a fight for the heart and soul of America, truly, not rhetorically. And that that when there's no place for labor, there's no place for work teachers, where there's no place for African Americans and Latinos and Muslims and Arab Americans, you start to get to a place where there's no place for any of us. And we have to stand up against that. And I think this is an election about that. And education is a piece of that. Pluralism in our schools, putting the public back into public education, assuring equal schools, equally resourced, irregardless of what zip code you live in, is essential. And there's really a fight going on over those questions. And we believe that the Democratic ticket, State Board of Education candidates are standing for that. Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, this idea of like keeping public education public, it's something that really resonates in communities like Detroit, where they might not have a school in the neighborhood that is a public school, that they may have to take their children to a charter just to have a school nearby. How do you get the urgency of that message to resonate with voters who, you know, maybe they just live in a community where there are only public schools and they've never had to deal with the idea of privatization of their system?
Well, I think the charter school thing is out of the bottle, but that they need to be held to the same standards as the public schools. That where they pop up needs to be decided by someone other than them. That the quality of those schools is governed. But the most important thing here is that we maintain good and powerful and well-resourced public schools, and that the community is part of the decision making for those schools. And that's being taken out of their hands now.
Can I just add, So it's not just in Detroit and Flint where you have this marketplace of chaos where most kids don't go to a traditional public school like DPS. They go to this crazy quilt of largely for-profit charters, most of whom don't educate kids but take tax dollars. It's not just there that the resistance on the right wing and the legislature for any quality control on new charters is hurting all public school students. It's also around the state. I mean, the fact that you have places like Plymouth Canton where for-profit operators are opening up elementaries where they can make a buck and market them and drain students from Plymouth Canton schools, that puts stress on Plymouth Canton, and their kids don't get a quality education, and the kids that make the choice of a bad charter don't get educated. You can't have 350 new school districts open up in a state over the last few years, you know, 12 years, in a state that has 200,000 less students, K-12 students. You have more schools chasing tons fewer students, and nobody's winning, and kids' education is suffering in both charters and traditional public schools.
So let me say this. My wife is a public school teacher, and she works really hard. She works evenings. She pays for materials out of her pocket. She meets with parents. She created parenting programs. And a system that does not support that, a system that does not put the public back into the public schools, a system that doesn't give parents a voice, a system that doesn't give local legislators a voice, needs to be revamped, and not the way that that's happening in the legislature now.
Okay, you were also able to talk with Deb Thomas.
Yeah, that's correct. We did a brief walk-and-talk interview as she was walking out. Although she's only going for the last 2 years of Joan Larson's tenure on the Supreme Court, she is definitely the more charismatic personality between her and Frank Szymanski. She did a good job of kind of rallying crowds and getting people up there. A big thing for them also, though, is because with the presumptive reinstatement of straight party voting, at least for this election, they're really going to have to encourage voters to go down there and hit that nonpartisan section of the ballot and get to them.
You know, in your campaign for the Supreme Court, what do you think is going to be the overriding theme of your campaign?
Restorative justice. We need to have treatment courts. We need to assist those who end up at the courthouse. Most people are there because something has gone awry in their lives. So we need to be able to connect those people with the necessary services so that we can rebuild communities by restoring justice, restorative services.
What do you think is going to get people out to the polls? What do you think is going to resonate with voters most?
A need for a change, and that we should not be a punitive society, that if we work together, we all rise together, and that we need to be working together, that we need to come together as a community to provide justice for everyone.
Mm-hmm. And so what are some of the challenges, do you think, in getting the electorate, especially in, you know, places like Detroit, to go and use the nonpartisan section of the ballot to get them down there?
I think Detroit has come a long way in their understanding that the judges are elected on the nonpartisan ballot. We have a number of judges. We have 60 judges in the circuit court alone. And then we have at least 20 judges in the district court. So Detroiters have become aware that when you vote for judges, you go to the nonpartisan ballot.
All right, who else were you able to talk to?
I was also able to talk to Minority Leader Sam Singh and talk to him also about this idea of pluralism.
Oh, the floor leader, Sam Singh.
Yes, along with, and this was something also that I talked about with MDP Chair Brandon Dillon, and how much that they're running on this as sort of the singular unifying issue for their campaigns.
All right, we'll listen to Sam Singh first, and then we'll cut to Brandon Dillon.
You know, we're looking at a 9-seat deficit going in there.
Sure.
What do you think it's going to take to centralize these resources and get the push to have these seats flipped and have the floor in your favor?
Well, we feel really good about our chances here in 2016. Most of the seats that we're contesting are actually open seats, so that's actually the best time to be able to win this. You have a top of the ticket, which the presidential gets more Democrats out to vote traditionally, but because of the dynamic between the Secretary Clinton and Donald Trump being up 10 points sometimes to 12 points depending on the poll, you know, we feel really good that in some of these districts that the top of the ticket's actually going to help us win some of those seats. So overall, we're really bullish about our chances here coming into November.
I noticed that, like, Democrats keep coming back to the theme of pluralism and casting this election as either an embrace or rejection of pluralism. Do you think that this is something that's going to resonate in voters in these districts where it could go one way or another?
Well, again, you know, I think people have watched what's happened over the last 6 years here in the state of Michigan. You know, their schools are not better off than they were when they started. The economy is not actually working for them. And so when they take a look that Republicans have run the state for the entire time, it's time for a change. And so I think you're going to see that not only on a national level, but on a state level, that people are going to say, yeah, we want a divided government. We want Democrats, because that will force the governor and the Senate to begin to have to find compromise. And because right now the economy is only working for the top 1% and for people who own businesses, but not for the person who works at that business. And if you had something where we all had to work together, we'd have better policies, we have better roads, and we have better funding for our schools.
You know, like kind of the fulcrum, what's going to hinge up on here. Do you think that can translate upstate, you know, in these really homogenous communities?
Well, I think the message of, you know, do we adhere to the founding principles of our most precious public documents and actually choose a candidate that actually cares about working together, whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, or independent, or a person like Donald Trump, who really doesn't have any even fundamental understanding of what it means to be part of a constitutional democracy, given his words. I think that'll translate all over the state. Obviously, we've got some work to do in areas where he's stoking fear and division, but I think ultimately the people of Michigan understand that, you know, we have to work together to solve problems, and Donald Trump offers none of that, whereas Hillary Clinton and all the Democrats are actually talking about working together and using our diversity as a strength.
All right, and you were also able to talk with Fred Durhall III and Ian Conyers.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, a big push within this convention is the idea that the Democrats really want, really badly, to get the House back. And Fred Durhall, you know, he met and spoke with Ian Conyers in one of the congressional district meetings. And although Ian Conyers defeated Durhall's father in the primary, there is apparently no bad blood between them. And they're really pushing to get to these, you know, while the seats that they're in may be safely Democratic, they're really pushing to get these volunteers, these people willing to pound the pavement, out into these districts that seem likely to flip. Fred Durhall mentioned places like Muskegon and Marquette as areas that he thought that could be flipped in blue.
Well, I think Fred Durhall, of course, obviously wants to flip the chamber, so he can start looking at maybe chairmanships or something like that. It's more fun to be in the majority than minority, that's for sure.
I think that is the most important thing, being, you know, on one common cause. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people win elections, people lose elections. You know, my dad did a very, you know, good job, came up a little bit short. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, hoping that Ian will show a lot of promise in Lansing up here. And so,
yeah, a good mustache goes a long way.
Well, maybe. Maybe it's the mustache or, mm-hmm. you know, but names go a long way as well.
Yeah, certainly.
But I think he'll have the opportunity to really live up to the name. You know, I'm very encouraged by some words that I've heard from him. Mm-hmm. I think he'll get together, or we'll get together, we'll roll up our sleeves and make sure that, you know, we work the best for our district.
I know in your speech you mentioned Muskegon and Marquette.
Yeah.
You know, what sort of things are you looking at in terms of mobilization, you know, in these regions that are kind of isolated in terms of, like, their populations?
Well, I think one thing that we want to identify is that a lot of these districts across the state that even are Republican control have urban epicenters within mm-hmm. those districts. I think we've got to come together from, you know, safe Democratic seats and get out onto some of these seats farther, you know, out of state mm-hmm. and make sure we mobilize and organize those voters as well, get them out to vote, make sure turnout is high as we can in these urban communities, that will make a change in the general election, I think.
Mm-hmm. And so will this be your primary focus in the run-up to November?
Oh, this is my primary focus. You know, I have two primary focuses. Number one, of course, is taking the House back. I'm tired of sitting in the minority, okay? And I think we're going to do that. I really feel it. We're down 9 seats. We've got mm-hmm. great candidates. And then the second focus is, you know, making Hillary Clinton president of the United States. Mm-hmm. Of course, we don't want Donald Trump to, you know, be the commander-in-chief.
I guess, you know, walk me through your primary campaign a little bit, what your focus was and how you're going to shift towards November.
So we focused on Doors, large community. You've got 4 cities. You've got 3 congressional districts. You've got 6 or 7 state rep districts and countless city council members. We knew that the best way to get outside of the political realm was just to take our campaign straight to the Doors. Mm-hmm. Now, we started in January. If you recall, I was running for state rep for 3 months before the state Senate seat became available. Mm-hmm. And so the transition became a look at once that seat was available, what was the demographic, what was the area, and what was the folks who were really in need of leadership. So when we looked at the west side where I grew up, Bagley, down Tireman on West Grand Boulevard, where my Uncle Nate had his first dealership, and to Lincoln Park, Allen Park, and Southgate, we knew that we'd have an opportunity to go down and get some Dems, but we had to do it face-to-face.
Yeah. Speaking about family, tell me a little bit about Team Conyers.
Exactly. Hashtag Team Conyers. Well, what we wanted to make sure we were doing is having folks remember all the works that the congressman has done, not the legacy of him in particular, but the legacy of what his father was able to do as something that every American family has dreamed about. My great-grandfather got to Detroit from Georgia in 1923 and lived to see his oldest son become a congressman, his second oldest son become a fantastic leader in the automotive industry through sales. Breaking those barriers is what Team Conyers is all about.
Would you look at your efforts to represent your district as, I guess, taking up the family mantle in that sense?
In a sense, public service has been what our family is about, standing up for working families, whether it's, standing on those picket lines back when folks didn't have a right to organize, or where we are now, which is standing up for folks on those subcommittees where they're underrepresented. No one likes to be under what they feel like is emergency management, and in particular, I feel like it's my job to grab that baton and take it to the new generation.
Okay, yeah. Tell me a little bit about how you're structuring your campaign. You know, you got a nice last name behind you that's got a lot of recognition. You got the mustache. Tell me how that plays into things.
So in terms of what we're doing now, the primary was the real focus. The Republican challenger will take just as serious as anyone will. So we're going to run a robust campaign continuing to knock doors. You know, we won a large portion of the district, but there's some folks that didn't go our way. So we've got our work cut out for us in terms of bringing them along to make sure that they understand what we're doing a second that I get into lame duck.
Do you think you're going to have a role to play in looking at some of these seats that could flip?
Absolutely. There's 9 right now in the House we're looking at, and we love to take as many of them as possible. We want to take the energy from our campaign and make sure we distribute it to folks across Southeast Michigan and all over the country, or all over the state if we need to.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Simon and Jacob for the coverage over the weekend. Thanks to Vicky for making the pot of coffee today. Thank you, Vicky, for that. Jack, for stopping by. John, for not making any noise while we're doing this cutout. And Simon, who's singing the Star Spangled Banner here as we're going out?
This is our own representative, Sherry Gay Denogo.
Well, that is fantastic, and she will sing us out. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.